company of forward thinkers with more than 55,000 employees around the globe and products in 58 customer countries, Raytheon has established itself as a trusted partner. From detection to action, we give our customers a decisive advantage. Customer-driven, technology-powered, Raytheon, revolutionizing defense capabilities.
Hello, and welcome to the Emerging Tech Horizons podcast. I'm Arun Serafin, Executive Director of the Emerging Technologies Institute here at NDIA. Today's podcast will focus on the joint warfighting concept and a new paper from ETI called Enabling the Joint Warfight that discusses the role that advanced technologies will play in making that concept a reality. According to the Pentagon, the joint warfighting concept is a threat-informed operational concept that provides an overarching approach to how the joint force will operate and fight as a team across all domains. The joint warfighting concept guides numerous operations, activities, and investments throughout DoD, providing a common goal which the military services are supposed to strive to achieve. Additionally, the JWC informs how DoD partners in industry and with the interagency community to support joint warfighting efforts. My guests today to discuss all of those words are the Honorable Al Schaefer and one of our own associate researchers here at ETI, Wilson Moss. Al moderated a series of four workshops hosted by NDIA last year, which covered the joint warfighting concept and the four strategic directives that serve as requirements frameworks around which new operational concepts for modern, distributed, information-based warfare can be developed. Al Schaefer is currently the director of Washington operations at the MIT Lincoln Laboratory, a federally funded R&D center that works for the Pentagon on advanced research and technologies. But I've known Al for many, many decades, two decades at least now. And he's had a long and distinguished government career, including being confirmed by the Senate in January 2019 as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, where he's one of the key leaders on all Pentagon acquisition activities. And he previously served in a number of DoD science and technology leadership positions, including Director of the NATO Collaboration Support Office. He was Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, leading and coordinating OSD, service, DARPA, and other S&T activities for the Pentagon. And a couple of times, numerous times, he was the Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. Before all of that, it follows a long career in the Air Force where Al retired as a full colonel. His partner in all of this is Wilson Miles from ETI. Wilson Miles's research and analysis portfolio with us at ETI includes analyzing hypersonics and directed energy supply chains. He looks at the ethics of artificial intelligence. He's working on the joint warfighting concept paper and other modernization and tech policy issues. He received his master's degree in international affairs from American universities. So with that, please join me in welcoming Al and Wilson to today's podcast. So let's get right into it, Al. What exactly is the joint warfighting concept? Is it a document? Is it a doctrine? Who writes it? Who can see it?
So, Arun, thank you. And thank you for hosting this. I think it's very, very important for government and industry to come together for this. I don't think the question, what exactly is the joint warfighting concept, is the correct one. I'll get to that answer first, but more important is why. And why was rolled out by then the vice chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Hyten, who we both know very well, in, I will get the year incorrect, but somewhere around 2021.
And it sprang, did it as part of the kickoff
of the ETI, absolutely. Yeah. So what I remember, and I've seen General Hyten say this a couple of times, the genesis of the joint warfighting concept for all domain operations came from a series of war games within the Pentagon. And to quote General Hyten, we got waxed, we being the US. We were beaten, the adversary ran rings around us. That, by the way, still exists. Mark Kansian, from CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies, ran a series of war games in late 2022, leading to a report in January 2023 assessing the outcome of 28 war games between for a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. The conclusion for all of these war games was that we are not structured correctly to fight that type of fight in that type of environment. And the CSIS studies, ultimately they concluded a summary of 28 war games that China would not be able to get lodgment on Taiwan if four things occurred. One, the U.S. entered the war immediately. Second, the Taiwanese offered strong resistance. Third, the Japanese allowed basing rights at the beginning of the conflict. And fourth, there were sufficient munitions. All four of those assumptions are questionable. And yet, even with all four of those assumptions, the U.S. lost in an average 2 to 3 aircraft carrier groups, somewhere between 20 and 30 surface ships, somewhere between 500 and 900 aircraft, most of which were on the ground, and about 10,000 casualties to U.S. and allied forces. These types of losses are unacceptable, and that tracks the war games that were held inside the Pentagon that I saw with General Hyten. So that got the Joint Staff thinking, how do we fight differently? And although the department has long talked about joint fights, we really never organized and equipped that way. The joint warfighting concept for all domain operations is really, at least in the first instantiation, the four things that the warfighting staff, the senior uniformed officers, believe needed to be done to enhance our capability to fight in a contested environment. First and foremost was joint all domain command and control. This had been around for a long time. I've had the pleasure of working for Secretary Kendall a couple of times. He and I have talked about this, and this is not a new concept. So we've talked about a single integrated air picture, SIAP, for a long time, a lot of different things, where we'd be able to communicate from one service to another, any sensor to any platform. That has not happened. So we still end up fighting in soda straws. The second concept was precision fires, and actually precision long-range fires. That is bringing the right weapon to a target, no matter if it comes from a Navy, Army, Air Force, or Marine platform. Again, that's something we have not been able to really do. The third thing was contested logistics. If you look at any type of conflict in the Indo-PACOM, and for those of you who've gone across the Pacific Ocean, it is a long, long way. And China has looked at the way we've organized the fight, the PRC China, and have done things to prevent our forces from being in close. So in that type of environment, we have to think about how do we get logistics resupply, re-equipping, munitions, fuel, food, all of that into the fight. And then finally, the last thing is information advantage, because just because you can communicate it doesn't mean that you can turn those digits into something that's actionable. So those are the four pillars of the joint warfighting concept. The joint staff is moving on and trying to develop more concepts. Your question is it a document? It is a document. It is classified. It is very classified. Although industry can't see the entirety of it, I would love to see the department put out an unclassified version of the joint warfighting concept. We need to let industry know what the department needs so they can spend their IRAD correctly and deliver capabilities that the warfighter wants. You know, we often hear the phrase, which you know I do not like, Valley of Death. The Valley of Death comes about when we don't communicate.
So, and that communication today needs to go beyond just those parts of industry that have the clearances.
Absolutely.
To see these documents, or the retired military folks who can really understand those documents. We're trying to expand the defense industrial base. We're trying to do more with small businesses and universities. there's got to be a way to show some of these concepts, some of these challenges to those kind of innovators as well.
Well, we've got to do that. One of the things that you will notice is that creativity tends to get stifled with size. It's just that's the nature of a bureaucracy. So you get a lot of the smaller, more agile companies coming along, and they come up with some really good solutions. And what I'm noticing now is a tiering in the defense industrial base. Of course, we have the big primes. Then we have the firms that were formed. And I probably shouldn't do this, but I'm going to name a couple of them. You know, Anduril, Palantir, Epirus, all of which are medium-sized companies who can move more quickly than the big primes and are good. But they're now becoming larger and more stodgy. So we have another undercut of people who really, really, really come up with great ideas. And we need a way to tell them what we need. So one of my great frustrations when I was running research and engineering was we would get all these people coming in with small business innovative research or the STTR answers, and they'd be exquisite technologies answering the wrong problem. If we let industry and smart people know what problem we're trying to solve, I'm confident that our industrial base at all tiers will come in with better solutions. Right now, that's a limitation.
So Wilson, NDIA kind of takes up a little bit of that challenge and decides to run this workshop series with Al at the helm here. Can you share more about that workshop series that ETI run? Why were those panels and panelists chosen? What were the goals of the panels?
Yeah, so like Al mentioned, there were four workshops held basically through last spring to last late fall. And they were looking at each directive, so JADC2, Joint Fires, Contested Logistics, and Information Advantage. And the workshops were moderated by Mr. Schaefer himself. And the panelists consisted of folks from government and industry, so different stakeholders from, for example, the JROC, the Joint Requirements Oversight Council, Indo-PACOM, different offices within R&E. We also had some people from the big defense primes that participated as well. And just on the note, in terms of articulating to the industrial base, there was an individual from industry who said, hey, we build these things. You just have to tell us how you want to do command and control, for example. Really, each panel was going into what is each directive trying to achieve? What are some of the technical efforts underway that are trying to get at those problems? And then what are some of the barriers preventing DoD from actually achieving some of the goals outlined by each directive and then the overall joint warfighting concept?
So you since then have turned this series of panels into a paper called Enabling the Joint Warfight, which is now available on the ETI website, which I understand summarizes the whole series of panels and pulls out key findings and recommendations. So based on that work and putting together this paper, can you take us through the four strategic directives that we've been talking about? I guess it's JADC2, Joint Fires, Contested Logistics, Information Advantage. These were the themes of each of the sessions. What are each of those directives trying to achieve?
Yeah, so Al hinted at them earlier, just to build off of that. So the first is JADC2. And really, JADC2 is both a network and a capability. And it's really trying to connect the quote-unquote right sensor to the right shooter. And it's in plain English, that basically means whoever's engaged in operations has the ability to access information from different sensors, whether they be ground-based, air-based, space-based, and really is able to use that information to their advantage. And really, when we talk about it, we think of interoperability, but interoperability across all domains, across different classification levels, as well as interoperability with allies and partners, in addition to modern and legacy platforms. So there's different levels to this. And I guess I would just move on to joint fires. Again, it's aggregating multiple shooters from different locations, really to deliver synchronized fires for mass effect. And historically, the targeting cycle has been quite stovepiped. The services typically prefer to use, the sensors that they practice and are more comfortable And so it's shifting culture, and it's a shifting mindset, which, as I understand it, can get a little bit of pushback. And maybe I think Al could talk about that a little bit later. But really, again, Joint Fires is employing different shooters, working at different speeds. All of that is arriving to the same target. And then the third is contested logistics. And so that's really describing a problem set, like Al mentioned. So increased threats to supply chains, reduced mobility, and really the need to operate in a resource-constrained environment. And so within the panels and the paper, it's really talking about how do we build flexibility into logistics, into planes, into our operations so that the warfighter has really what they need at the time that they need it. And so, again, it's things like creating new innovative ways to deliver fuel, munitions, and other supplies to the front lines, really against an adversary that can strike at long range. And so the fourth that we go into is, again, information advantage, which underlies JADC2, contested logistics, and joint fires. And we discuss how it really gets at just decision dominance or decision superiority, which is a desired state so that the commander can sense, understand, decide, and act faster than the adversary and more effectively. And so we go into some of the key technology enablers of each of those directives. And I think we're going to talk about policy recommendations later, and we can get into that then.
So before we dive into some of the ongoing efforts in DoD, so Al, I'm old enough to remember things like Joint Vision 2010, Joint Vision 2020, mm-hmm. Joint communications efforts, net-enabled command capability, joint tactical radio system, list goes on and on. Does this effort at jointness, this joint warfighting concept, feel different to you this time?
The concept is not different to Rome. So when you go back and look at those, the Joint Vision 2010, Joint Vision 2020, it really talked about much of the same types of things. There's a recognition we needed to fight more jointly. I think the difference now is that we're getting enough technological sophistication and advancement that some of these things we can actually do. So, and we're getting, and this is going to sound very harsh to people my age, we're getting what I would call digital natives coming up through the ranks of colonels and, you know, 1 and 2 stars. I grew up, and I remember, even though I was an Air Force guy, I deployed with the Army, and we would do mission planning by dropping down pieces of acetate and grease pencils out in the field. Modern officers, as they progress through, don't think like that. So they're much more comfortable working with computer-aided things. We're getting to the point where we have 5G instead of 1G. There are problems with 5G, but the point is you get more of a throughput. We're also at a place where we are developing, and I'm starting to jump ahead, developing algorithms to assist with decision aids. A lot of people call that artificial intelligence. That's another phrase that I think is overused. But at the end of the day, how do we corral and make sense of a great deal of data quickly to make a decision? When I was a young guy running around the field, the person who would win was the guy who had the biggest bicep. Now it's who can get to the decision and action most quickly. And that is something that we have to continually, I think, strive for. So coming back around to it, we had the aspiration in Joint Vision 2010, Joint Vision 2020. We didn't have the tools. We didn't have the technology to keep up with it. What makes it hard now is we, the U.S. and allies, are not the only people with those tools. So rest assured that China is working very hard on artificial intelligence for the specific purpose of reducing the decision cycle time. So we are now in a race of decision cycle time, and that's not something the DoD can do by itself. It needs industry to bring in the best. And it needs kids who show up for work in aloha shirts. You know, again, people I worked with all showed up in coats and ties like this. You need to go out and talk to kids who are wearing Aloha shirts and flip-flops coming to the office, but understand what they're trying to deliver and deliver capabilities, because they do a marvelous job. And oh, by the way, I think a lot of those kids don't go to work for the big primes either.
So Wilson, you're a younger guy, maybe not a kid. You are unfortunately wearing a tie right now, but I'm going to ask you this question anyway. So in looking at the workshop series and the paper you wrote, you know, tying into what Al said, what are some of the technical efforts underway that make this joint vision a reality?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I'll raise three things, I think. For a specific technology, I would say cloud computing was raised through multiple panels, and really cloud computing will enable DoD to move data across agencies and services and classification levels really at unprecedented speed. It's a very new technology. There's a lot of utility there. And just as an example of that, one of the service panelists for the Information Advantage panel said that cloud-based infrastructure is one of the most critical key abilities for making use of information at a global scale. I think that's quite telling. The second is something that's relatively new. There's an idea floating around of creating a joint futures organization within the joint staff. So there's a fairly new cross-functional team within the J7 that was created, and they're looking at formally proposing this idea within the joint staff. And really, it's designed to look at how to help align the joint staff, the services, the combatant commands on timelines, processes, and capabilities. And then the third thing that I'll mention is really this quite a large focus on experimentation. And so I'm sure we're all familiar with you know, the Rapid Defense Experimentation Reserve Raider, which for the people who don't know, it's really looking to facilitate modernization efforts through rapid prototyping and experimentation of joint military technologies. And this is trying to get at some of the problems that we're describing. And just most recently in October, there was a 10-day exercise in Indiana looking at different technologies. I think there were 11 full-scale assessments of new technologies from traditional and non-traditional companies. And so you're starting, well, you have been seeing, but you're still seeing that those kinds of efforts focused on technology by DoD.
Arun, can I amplify that? Because I think Wilson's answer was very good, but I'm going to push back on some of it. And what I'm going to push back on is a typical bureaucratic response in the Pentagon when they have a hard problem is, let's form a this, that, or the other thing. Let's form an organization. Let's form a task force. Let's form a cross-functional team.
The only thing worse is writing a law.
Well, that would be yes. But as I'm saying this critically, I will talk back to something, and this is not technical, but was a highlight of my career, and that was the Mine Resistant Ambush Protection Task Force. Got very good people, but what set that apart was I and a couple of my friends, all in the task force, got to go see a guy by the name of Secretary Gates once a week. His first question is, how many did you build this week, and how many got overseas? The metric was, how many got into the hands of the warfighter. So I think that we have to remember as we go forward, technology is wonderful. I've spent my career in technology. Technology that does not get into the hands of the warfighter is empty. And that's why I hear about things like, and I'm sure the people who are putting this together, I love a joint futures organization. I hope they're not there to admire the problem. I hope they're there to deliver something that will get into the hands of the warfighter that will make a difference. It doesn't have to be perfect. We are replete with trying to field perfect systems. We talked a little bit about technologies, but there's engineering things. Open systems architectures and digital engineering will allow us to field things that are not perfect with the option of being able to improve the performance, improve the capabilities as it matures. So we have to think about the whole acquisition chain differently. It's not, it can't be static waterfall drop. It's got to be set up in a way that we can layer in capabilities as they come along. And that was one of the great revelations I had going through these panels. If we try to do everything perfectly in the first time, it will take 5 to 7 years, and China will be on the doorstep of the presidential palace in Taiwan.
So as you went through these panels and developing the paper, you ran into these technical challenges, you ran into these, they're almost cultural and bureaucratic challenges. Are there some recommendations that came out in the paper that you think might address it? And I guess I will just throw out there that, you know, I'm spending some time thinking about the Pentagon's budgeting process these days as a part of the PPBE commissioner. Were there any thoughts on maybe the how money moves, whether it could be done differently?
So what we talked about during the workshops was the standard, the department needs more flexibility with money, yada, yada, yada. That's kind of hollow. Everybody says that. From my perspective, the department needs to work with Congress. And I would say, instead of having all these little pots of R&D money out there, there needs to be a large AI fund that the department is accountable to Congress on and choose the frequency. Semi-annually, quarterly, every 4 months, go over and tell Congress what they're doing to make sure that we uphold the Constitution of the power of the purse. Congress does have the authority and the right to make sure we're spending money correctly. I didn't meet many people in Congress who didn't want the department to succeed. They want to succeed. So how do you work within that framework and get both DOD needs and congressional responsibilities met? And there are ways to do that. Larger pots, shorter delivery cycles, inform Congress and each other what we're doing. So one of the great enablers, and I said I hate the phrase, is AI, but it's really handling large data for decisions. You can't, in my opinion, give an organization $200 million and say, come back in a year and tell me what you've done. That's not the speed we're on. You can say, come back every 4 months and tell me what you're trying to accomplish and decide whether or not that's making progress. So I would look at it as it has to be any PPBE reform has to include more of a dialogue between the performers and Congress. Recognize Congress has a role. And I firmly believe, notice I don't have an appropriator here, I firmly believe that if you have a larger pool of funds to work on a specific problem, large data for delivering capabilities, if you keep Congress informed, they will be fine. Similarly, autonomy. How many wonderful lines in the department, program lines, do we have that say, I'm working on autonomy? All kinds of them. How many do we need? I don't think you need a separate autonomy line for every little effort. You need a line that says, this is what we're going to try to do with autonomy, whether it is Deputy Secretary Hicks's replicator program, which is really about autonomy, whether it's what the Navy's trying to do with and DARPA, with autonomous systems for doing undersea logistics resupply. There's a lot of different things you can do. The important part is the department has to be more willing to be open with Congress, what they're trying to do, what failed, what worked, but not have to go back into this mother may I reprogram all the time. So there was a discussion about that. How do we make larger pots, but still provide the oversight? That's a long answer, but I mean, I think it's important. We can't have a balkanization of the money and expect to be agile.
So along those lines then, and pretend you get to the world where you can request larger pots of money maybe funds,
mm-hmm.
and get into some rhythm with the oversight community within the Office of Secretary of Defense, within OMB, on the Hill, what would you have the department do with that money? What kind of investments sure. would you like to see them being made?
So, and this comes back to our discussion. So the enabling technologies, data to decisions, artificial intelligence, whatever you want to call it, autonomous systems. I think for things like joint fires, remote BDA. So the thing that makes joint fires different is these are long range fires at 500 miles. How do you do battle damage assessment? We have to figure out how to do that. So that is a process of tying together overhead imagery, whether it's from a satellite or a UAV, I don't care which, but to be able to tell whether or not the target has been destroyed. For contested logistics, it is amazing if you go to, and General Minahan has asked for help with this, if you go to the Air Mobility Center that General Minahan is trying to plan the logistics flow, they're still doing that with Excel spreadsheets. So how do we take what most people would call AI and do route optimization? And oh, by the way, that's also a commercially viable technology, but we want it first in the DoD. How do you reroute things as bases go down from weather, from attack, I don't care what, but how do you use modern tools to get greater throughput? The other thing I would say is we need to quit talking about specific technologies, in my opinion, and talk more about what capabilities we're trying to enable. And the capabilities we're trying to enable is faster decisions, ability to communicate between any platform anywhere, ability to optimize flow, ability to have total asset visibility for logistics. These are different than saying, I need a fancy quantum sensor. Quantum sensor is how you're going to get there. What you want to get to is where are the assets and how are they moving around?
So I think you're saying that the Pentagon, Department of Defense as a customer, doesn't need to dictate the specific solution type.
Yeah.
Or either rather signal, there's really a market here if you help me develop this kind of capability for the future. Is that fair?
Yes, very fair. And in fact, I will give you the analogy to that. Back in about 2014, when I was still involved in running R&E, we decided to have a thrust technology every year, or thrust capability. The first one was autonomy. And we didn't go in and try to tell industry and the services what to build in autonomy. It's rather, how can we use autonomy to overwhelm an adversary radar? How can we use autonomy to do a logistics depot and not endanger people's lives? So we've done this before, and the department can do that again. The department, listen, I love folks in the department. They're great people. They're not the smartest people out there. There's a lot of smart people out there. And the power comes from harnessing smart people in government, industry, academia, and when I say industry, big industry and little industry, and try to understand what problem you're trying to solve. For folks who are listening to the podcast, if you don't know what the Heilmeyer Catechism is, go look at the Heilmeyer Catechism. Question one is...
That's a great idea. We should do a podcast on the Heilmeyer Catechism.
We actually should. What are you trying to achieve in pure language, in plain language, no jargon? It's a simple concept. And if you try to follow that, you're not saying, I want a quantum sensor that's going to do 10 to the minus 28. It's how can I tell time to take away the need for GPS? Long answer, but I mean, it's important.
So Wilson, following onto that, what are some of the recommendations? We mentioned a few here that come out in the paper as recommendations for DoD, as services or agencies, as we all try to move together to meet the goals of this joint warfighting concept.
Yeah, so Al's mentioned focusing on MOSA, modular open system architecture. He mentioned a unclassified version of the joint warfighting concept, all great ideas. Just to add on to that, though, we've also got really integrating space-based assets from DoD agencies and the intelligence community into decision-making networks for warfighters. You know, at the moment, places like NGA, NSA, DIA, these agencies' data is not tactically available to the warfighter in real time. And so, you know, their space-based ISR assets should be available and it should be integrated. A couple key...
And integrated with commercially available
data. Exactly. And there are a couple key considerations, though. These organizations have to make their data available. And so not just that, they have to make it compatible. And so these are some considerations there. Other quick things are, you know, continuing to invest in, you know, layered system of air defenses to protect logistics assets, bases. In terms of joint fires, you know, commit to consistent munitions purchases for, you know, high priority munitions. So those are just a couple that we mentioned in the report.
Yeah, Arun, I'd like to foot stomp the data, because the Department of Defense is not always good about sharing data that they can share. If we're going to move with industry to greater model-based systems engineering, to be able to simulate performance of future systems, we need data, and industry needs data. And if the department says, I'm not going to share my data, then we got a problem. So everything we're trying to do now rests on exquisite data, or as good a data as you can get, and then build the models around it.
So it's relevant for those NDIA members that are thinking about how to support the Department of Defense in current operations, as well as NDIA members thinking about that future potential conflict in the Indo-PACOM theater. So bringing it down to that sort of reality for the members, what's your advice, Wilson, Al, for NDI members to become more aware of the joint warfighting concept and its implications for them and their business models, and for future upcoming DoD programs?
Oh, thanks. So I think that there's a couple of things. While we have not been successful in publishing the joint warfighting concepts, even the unclassified version, there's an enormous amount of information out there. I would recommend that people go out and read that and think about, in their program or product space, what could they do to improve the capability delivery? Not what cool technology can I deliver? What can I do that would enhance capabilities? So can I do something that would give us better logistics asset visibility in an electronic warfare environment? You know, there's probably some guys tinkering around in garages in Sunnyvale, California, who can figure that out. What people can do first is, while the department needs, in my opinion, to publish unclassified joint warfighting concepts, at the same time, there's an awful lot out there published.
All right. So, you know, we talked about how this is real for industry that's trying to support the department in today's operations with Ukraine and in the Middle East, as well as those that are positioning themselves to support development of capabilities for future operations in the Pacific. So, Al and Wilson, what's your advice to NDIA members on what they can do to become more aware of the joint warfighting concept and what its implications are for them and their business models and business opportunities and for any upcoming DoD programs they might see as a result?
So, Arun, that's a terrific question, and there's not a simple answer, but I'll try to give you a simple answer. First, while I believe the department owes industry an unclassified joint warfighting concepts, that's something the joint staff and the leadership is going to have to decide. But there's an awful lot out there that's already been written about what is motivating the joint warfighting concepts. And frankly, I think we spend way too much time worrying about requirements and not enough time worrying about needs. So if you have a small industrial person, whether it's a 150-person company, 500-person, 30-person, or just some person with a garage in Sunnyvale, California, if they understand what the department is trying to do with the joint warfighting concepts, they can start to think about, can they build a capability? Notice I didn't say a technology. Build a capability that could help that fight. And I think in many cases that is correct. That in and of itself won't deliver capability. But what I would like to then see, and by the way, there's quite a bit of information on motivation of the joint warfighting concepts in the paper that NDIA, ETI is publishing and putting online. I think that gives a really good overview of the motivation. But I also would like to see NDIA get more involved in what I will call industry day type events and workshops. I know you do that with JADC too.
We did a bit of that with the Emerging Technologies Conference in August.
What I'm envisioning is even more. So have a contested logistics thing, have some operators come in and describe what they need, and then start to talk about and then make available to small business operators, program managers who can start to take ideas. Now, I think there were a lot of things that were not perfect with it, but when the Air Force used their pitch day for the SBIR, that actually did not work badly if they would have saved some money so some companies could have gone to phase two and phase three. So thinking about how do you get ideas in play without using up all the money to save some money for those things that work to move into capabilities. Getting the interaction between what I will call the trigger puller and the capability developer is vital. I think NDIA can play a significant role in making that happen. And that will bring strength to the NDIA members and industry trying to help the department.
That's a good challenge for us, Al. So, first step in that is Wilson's paper here. So, Wilson, last chance. Why would you recommend this to NDIA members to take a look at?
Yeah, well, as Al mentioned, it's a good overview of the joint warfighting concept and the four directives within that. And I would just say that, after you read it, if you have any, criticisms or any comments, I encourage you to reach out to us. We're happy to have that conversation and really figure out a good forum for, articulating changes or just, trying to contribute to the conversation. So we have those conversations all the time. So I really encourage that.
So with that, I want to say that's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thanks to Al Schaefer and Wilson Miles for the thought-provoking discussion and joining me today. Thank you all so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Emerging Tech Horizons. Please visit the ETI website and download Al and Wilson's new paper, Enabling the Joint Warfight, as well as taking a look at all of our upcoming events, webinars, and educational activities. If you enjoyed this podcast, please hit the like button and subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with all our latest content. Special thanks to Daniel Park and Melanie Yu for working behind the scenes to bring this podcast to you. Thank you again for joining us on Emerging Tech Horizons.